Welcome to Aspects of Riding with your host, James Kelly. For the next 60 minutes, we'll explore every aspect of riding, including how to create, format, and even sell your work. Now, let's get writing. Here's your host, James Kelly.
Hello, and welcome to Aspects of Riding. I'm your host, James Kelly, and my co-host for today's show is Cynthia Lee DeBoer, and our guest is Roger DeBlanc. And today we're going to be talking about the disciplined author. First, I would like Cynthia to introduce herself. Cynthia?
Hello. Yes, I'm an author, speaker, and an advocate for the disabled. And my goal and mission and passion in life is to help people change their perspectives about disabilities and depression by sharing some of my life stories.
Okay. And Cynthia, what are the books that you've written?
I've written Me, Myself, and I, EYE, which is about the realities of living with a prosthetic eye. And then Freedom from Depression, No Matter What Your Disability May Be. And that is a five-part book where the reader actually has a section that they can work out and understand just how special they are. And my third book is off genre. It is a children's book from 4 to 8, and it's called Jimmy's Magic Turtle.
All right. Our guest today is Roger DeBlanc. So Roger, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and where you grew up?
I'm a native of Las Vegas. I went to school here. I also went to college out at UNLV, where I earned my bachelor's degree in English. After I finished school, I wanted to write, but that's not always practical. So I got into libraries, and I've been in libraries, public libraries, for over 20 years now. And I went back to school, got my master's in information science, and I continue to work full-time as a public services librarian. And every off hour I have, I'm working on my writing. But I like to consider myself a reader, writer, librarian. For me, it all starts with reading, the love of language, books, ideas. And my wife, Allie, and I, we live out in Henderson, Nevada. And we have a little dog named Sophie that we love and spoil. But a librarian during the day and writer by every other hour. We're a reader and then a writer.
What's your latest book about?
My most recent novel is historical. All of my books are historical. I've written 4 historical novels. My most recent one is titled Prayers from the Far Quarter, and it's about a African Muslim, and he narrates this story, and it begins in 1850 in sub-Saharan Africa in a place called the Bornu Kingdom. And after the main character, his name is Isa Muhammad Rahman, after he's captured, he's dragged across the Sahara Desert, and he's sold at a slave auction in Tripoli, where a Dutchman actually purchases him and takes him to England, where he becomes involved with the abolitionist movement in England, which was very big in the 1850s all the way through the Civil War. It's during his time in England where he is under the aegis and the tutelage of this rich Britishman or Brit or Englishman that he is convinced by this man to go on an abolitionist mission to America. And when they get to America, he's abducted in Charleston, and he's sold into slavery in the antebellum South. As a Muslim, through all of his experiences, he finally gains his freedom, and he ends up in Boston, where he becomes active in the abolitionist movement. He meets Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison. And then as the novel progresses, he ends up serving in the Union Army during the Civil War. So the novel is really about the contributions and the sacrifices of Muslims throughout American history. And it's Islam that it's the guidance of Islam that strengthens Isa, the main character's humanity throughout the novel. And he also shares the peace and compassion of the religion throughout the book. And all his efforts are to gain inclusion for himself and his family as American citizens. So his journey becomes an opportunity for him to share Islam's message of accepting all people, all races, all faiths. And like I said, it's really a celebration in honoring Muslims who have been in this country and been in America since the very beginning. A large majority of the slaves were from countries in sub-Saharan Africa or West Africa that were Islamic. And so I was very captivated by this idea of telling a story that paid homage to the Muslim tradition in America, and the sacrifices that they made, and several of them ended up serving in the war and were soldiers and were veterans. And that's my most recent novel.
You've written, I believe you've written four novels, but you also wrote a book of poetry. Why don't you tell us about your debut book and then fill us in on the rest?
My first novel was from 2011. It was historical novel titled The Ramos Brothers Trust Castro and Kennedy. And it's about two young boys that grow up in Cuba and emigrate to the United States. And their lives cross paths with the two political figures of that era, Fidel and JFK. But the family in the book is kind of a microcosm for the tumultuous times of the era. The book is based very loosely on my father and uncle. My father was a Cuban immigrant, and he never met JFK or Fidel, but I thought it would be interesting to write a story where two brothers crossed paths with those two historical figures. But it's based very loosely on his life, some anecdotes that he told me worked their way into the story. And Fidel and JFK, I fictionalized them. I had a lot of fun with the book. It was very, very eye-opening. And just this year, the 2020 edition has a new cover on it. If you look online or go to my website or Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you can see the new cover. I'm really excited about it.
What was your second novel?
The second one also, I mentioned I do historical fiction, was titled The Sky Buries All Sorrow. And it basically is a saga, three generations of American family starting at Pearl Harbor and ending at 9/11. And just basically trying to capture everything that war does to a family over three generations and using those two bookend events, Pearl Harbor and at 9/11. And the influence of that book was my grandfather was a veteran of World War II. He was actually at Hickam Field, which was adjacent to Pearl Harbor, which was devastated just as much as the harbor itself. And I wanted to write a perspective of a soldier that was at Hickam Field and then take him all the way through the South Pacific through all the major battles, whether it was Guadalcanal, Okinawa, and then his trauma coming home after the war, and then how that affects his immediate family and then three generations forward through his grandson. And that was The Sky Buries All Sorrow. And then after that, I did a poetry book, like you mentioned. It was just a compilation of all of my poems that I'd written for 25 years. I just went through them and compiled my best pieces, I thought. And then after that, I felt like I was ready to write another novel. So I did a book titled The Destruction of Silence, which is about a young Native American man who suffers from abuse and addiction. And he goes on a journey to discover his family roots. And that book became somewhat of a mystery in terms of the character discovering his past and also trying to overcome why his father was so abusive to him. So that was a Native American tale that's based very loosely on my brother-in-law, who is Native American and suffered from abuse and addiction for many years. He was kind of the inspiration for that book.
All right. Well, I just want to let our audience know that we're observing the pandemic, you know, stay away from each other. So Cindy is at home. Roger's in the studio, but he's at least 8 feet away from me, if not more.
I think about 12 feet, James.
Yeah. So we're doing okay.
Thank you.
I want to ask you, well, we're going to be talking today about the disciplined author, and Lord knows I'm not, so I want to get some input from Roger on this. So I'm going to ask, the first question I'm going to ask is, Roger, how do you prepare to write every day?
As I mentioned earlier, it all starts with reading for me. I'm very disciplined. Kind of a creature of habit to the point of trying to stay uniform and regimental in everything I do. I wake up pretty early every day and I start off with a bowl of cereal with a book in front of me for about 90 minutes and just read. So it all starts with reading for me, staying disciplined with a schedule, my reading schedule, which always percolates my thoughts and inspires me. So it's always about immersing myself in someone else's ideas. What I like to always remember Toni Morrison saying is, when you enter a book or you experience a book, you're dancing with the mind of someone else. So I try to dance with someone else multiple times a day, in the morning, during the day, and then always at night before I go to bed, reading as well. So I try to say anytime I can have is to dance with someone else's mind with a book. So reading is my discipline. That's what inspires me. And when I'm immersed in a project, it just becomes any second that I can get to work on it, I work on it. But I also find that I wake up every single day. I wake up pretty early. I read. I work out every single morning, and that really helps to clear my mind. A 20-minute workout every single day, 365, 7 days a week. I don't deviate. I always do my workout, stretching, lifting weights, doing squats, arm curls. Just always keep some physical activity, which always clears my mind and releases endorphins, positive energy in my body. So believe it or not, that really helps me as a writer too, is the physical, keeping in shape, because it can be tiring when you devote yourself to a project like a novel for several years. You have to be ready to commit, and working out every day helps me to do that.
Cynthia, how are you? Are you a disciplined writer, or how do you write?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with Roger as far as the, you know, the physical part of it. The gentleman that made the Cray computers, which he, you know, years ago would take up an entire room, how he would clear his mind is he would go dig holes in his backyard and then go fill them back in, because it was mind, you know, it just freed your mind. You were able to just not think of anything. And for me, it's the same thing. It's like, get up, work out, and
wow,
things come to you. You know, things come to you. I always keep a pad beside my bed, because, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night with this amazing thing and, oh my gosh, I'm sure I'm going to remember it. Well, of course, by the morning you don't. So I've learned a hard lesson, and I do keep that by my bed. As far as, you know, the emotional side of my writing, every book that I've wrote has had a very emotional side to it, because I'm sharing a lot of my stories, including, you know, the children's book, because that was dedicated to my nephew who passed away. He was a day old, in fact. So for me, I have to have an outlet like working out or just cleaning the house, even taking a shower, you know, because you're sitting there and you're not thinking about anything. And so it's those times for me that really help the discipline of, okay, now I can go to the desk and now I can write. And as far as being disciplined 9 to 5, I do this or do that. No way. It just does not work in my world at all. It just, whenever something hits me, I write like crazy. And the other day on Facebook, it was just kind of one of those things. First of all, I don't believe in coincidences, so this was kind of perfect for what we're talking about. It was a fortune cookie little sign that this man by the name of Michael Sparks put on there. And it says, discipline is the refining fire by which talent becomes ability. And I just love that, because that's what it is, you know, the discipline that it takes to sit down. I don't know how many people I've talked to and they say, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. And 10 years later, I'm going to write a book, you know? And so being able to be disciplined enough to put it down on paper. And I know James's favorite line is, how do you start? Write your first sentence. And that really is it. And for me, I think the driving force is keeping the purpose in mind. What is the purpose of that book? Who is going to want to read it? And if you can keep that purpose in mind, that to me is a real big key to keeping a disciplined track of what I'm doing.
Yeah. Can I add something? You really said some stuff that I can relate to. My motto is that hard work is the muse. I truly don't think I have any special talent. I'm just very dedicated. And as soon as you start committing yourself to the project, stay true. What I say, stay true to the vision of the work. Mm-hmm. And when you devote the hard work to it, it starts to make sense. It will happen. The muse will then appear. At least that's my theory, is that hard work is the muse. So the process is part of it. And there's days that aren't good. There's days that are better than others. But I don't really believe in the idea that it just comes to you. You have to work at it, like anything. And like I said, even physical activity, working out every day, that releases, clears my thoughts, releases thoughts, develops thoughts. But it's just the hard work. And that's the only way to get there. Every sentence that I write for a book, it seems like it goes through 100 revisions. I might be more obsessive than others, but probably not. Anybody that writes and is serious about it knows how hard it is, and it's just repetition and work and work. I like to say, until you've built a fortress of manuscripts around yourself, you're not even close to finishing. And that's just the approach that I take. But for me, it is always starts with reading, and constantly immersing myself in my favorite authors. And like you said, getting started, one of my favorite quotes is from a poet named Seamus Heaney, who I revere. And he always said, writing is getting started, keeping going, and getting started again. And that always has resonated with me, that I wake up every day like that. Just get started and then keep going. And then as soon as you run out, well, then just start the cycle over again, whether it's later that day after you clear your mind or the next day. So to me, that resonated. And I always think of that quote from him.
I have to say that I write differently than both of you. I agree with a lot of what you're both saying. The only thing I can say is I'm not a disciplined writer. I'm actually an inspirational writer. I actually go on inspiration. And I know, Cynthia, you know that most of my work comes from dreams. I truly pay attention to, or I've grown to pay attention to what I'm dreaming at night. And if I think it's something that's significant, I'll get up at 4 a.m. and I'll write it down. And maybe it's just an outline, but I'll take that outline later on and I'll actually develop a story from it. I have to say probably 90% of all my ideas are based on a dream that I've had. So I can't say I'm disciplined in that I force myself to get up in the morning and sit down and write. I think it's just something that happens automatically when I envision something. And then as far as following through with the format, as far as creating the story, I'm not one of those who can sit down and say, I'm doing this today, because that's not the way my mind works. What I do find is that once I start writing something, sometimes I'm compelled to keep writing. So I may write viciously for like 2 or 3 days, you know, or voraciously. I may not stop until I've reached a certain point. And then if I have a place in the story where I'm uncertain of, I may go back and examine it a week later and start all over again and with that same process. So I can't say I'm disciplined at all, because I'm really not.
I think you are, because you have a style. And I used to think this too. I mean, I've been writing for a long, long time and I'm very committed to it. But I used to think, you know, you read someone's book and you read how they write or you find out how their process works. Like, oh my gosh, I don't do that. Am I not a writer? I think you have to find what works for you. I don't write every day. Like I always thought, oh gosh, Stephen King writes 3,000 words a day. I can never be a writer because I don't write 3,000 words a day. But when I commit to a project, it becomes a mission and I don't deviate. And it's always something inspiring. Like this last story I did, prayers from the Far Quarter. I've been fascinated with Islam for a long, long time. And I always wanted to do something with that. And when I started to realize that Islam had been in this country since the advent, since slaves were first brought over, I was inspired by that topic. And it was just about immersing myself in the research, which was writing, because I spent a whole year researching. Before I even wrote. So maybe in a lot of ways we are similar. I didn't write one word of the book for a full year. I spent a full year only researching. That's all I did. And then I typed up all those notes because I had to have immersion. I had to feel like I could do this. And it was doubt that actually drove me the whole way, because this idea had been in my head for 20 years. And I finally said, I need to start doing this. And then when the voice of the character came to me, I realized it's time to start researching this. But I guess I did it similar to you. Once this process started, I felt like every day the hard work gave me the inspiration to go back to it. But for a full year, I didn't write one word of the narrative. It was just immersion and research only. So in a lot of ways, I think your style is if it's effective, then you should do it any other way.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, because I always ask this of most of my guests. What is your background? I know you have a degree, but was it in journalism?
No, I was in English, and I actually then also, with an English degree, I wanted to write, but I was also very practical. I wasn't going to be one of those bohemians that moved out to Santa Monica and lived on a pier and tried to write the next great novel. I was very practical, so I briefly got into teaching for a while, but I found that it drained me to the point that it wasn't for me. I enjoyed it, though. I really enjoyed sharing ideas and inspiring people and inspiring students, but I found libraries, and that's really where I fit in. I'm immersed in books every day, and I'm doing the same thing in a lot of ways. I feel like every interaction I have with patrons is a little teaching moment at times, and I can have great discussions with people. But yeah, my background was an English major and then immersing myself in a career that also kind of reflects what I like to do outside of my work. And yeah, a lot of the books that I use for research, I'm right at my fingertips basically in the library system, where I can do interlibrary loans to get more esoteric books that I might need. So that's kind of my background. But I've always been fascinated with religion and interfaith dialogue. I've loved Islam for as long as I can remember. I revere the Prophet Muhammad as much as Jesus Christ. They both are invaluable to my life. I can't live without either one of them. For me, it's more about their teachings. I don't concern myself as much with the miracles. It's all about their teachings. To me, they're kindred spirits. I wanted this character in this most recent book to basically encompass, you know, not only the message of Islam, peace and compassion and generosity, but also all Muslims that had sacrificed and contributed to our country. He's kind of a encapsulation of all of those people, just like in Beloved, Toni Morrison's character of Beloved encompasses all of the trauma, all of the pain of slavery. My character, I hope, represents all of Islam.
I wanted to, this is kind of interesting too. I know you critique books, and I wanted to ask you, you self-published all your work, is that correct?
Yes, they're all independent. I've tried, like many people, for over 20 years to do those queries and find someone, but whatever reason, I haven't been fortunate enough to have a big publisher. So I've used the independent model, and basically on the consignment program where someone purchases a copy, I get a royalty from it. But I feel very fortunate for the books to be out there. I feel like I work as hard as any writer, same as you two would work on your work, or anybody that, you know, has a big publisher. So I'm very proud of the works. I've put in years of effort into making them the best they can be. And I think most people that have read them have hopefully gained something from them, or they've expanded or opened their minds to something that they weren't aware of before. That's my whole goal, is to take ordinary people, put them in extraordinary times, and hopefully have compassion for others and their plights in life and their struggles.
I know that you have a certain way of critiquing books, Roger, and I kind of find it fascinating. And I think maybe it stems from the fact that you are a self-published author, but I know that you try not to give a very harsh review. Instead, you try to you expose the creativity of a book, I suppose is the best way of putting it. Can you explain a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't get to your question earlier there. I'll go back to reading again. I really love to read. I always say one of my mantras, like I mentioned before, is hard work is the muse. One of my other mantras is read as much as you can, read as often as you can, make your reading goals more important than your writing goals. So every book that I read, I try to review on Goodreads, and I'm very proud of my reading resume on Goodreads, up to close to 900 ratings, and I've reviewed over 500 books. Basically, the way I look at it is the way Stephen King says, if I'm not connecting to a book, I usually might just slap 3 stars on it and just move on to the next. Wish the author the best and move on to the next. Any book that really stimulates me or impacts me, really opens my mind, I try to give a thoughtful review of the book and post it on Goodreads. And yeah, I have thousands of likes on my reviews on Goodreads. I'm very proud of my reviews. But I don't know if it's so much I'm trying to be gentle. If something inspires me, I'm going to express that. I'm going to give back to the author. That's another one of my mantras. I think you can read all of my mantras on Goodreads. I have 5 of them, and that's one of them is to support other writers at every opportunity available to you. So yeah, if I read something that really stimulates me, I'm going to do my best to articulate that and kind of pay back to that author how much they influenced me and inspired me to go to my craft and make it even better.
I know you have written poetry. You wrote one book of poetry, and then you have 4 novels out there, all dealing with historical fiction. Did you ever think about possibly writing in a different genre?
It's where your vision is at, what you're passionate about. People say that all the time. I think I probably couldn't write something in another genre because it's an art form. Like I look at people that can write those mysteries. James Patterson, there is an art form to what he does. I could never do it. I just don't see the world that way. Like when I see a vision for a book, it's usually something that encompasses, like this last book, 3 continents, a lot of years, historical based. That's what fascinates me. So hopefully I can give back to history and illuminate something that was marginalized and that someone can again gain or expand their mind through the story of the character. So probably no, I don't know. I mean, my third novel, The Destruction of Silence, did take on somewhat of a mystery. A lot of people that read that book said, it was a page turner, like what was going to happen to Thomas Newsome, the main character. And I didn't intend it that way, but I could see it did. It became a mystery. It was really this excavation into his family past and searching for answers to his family history. And that did become somewhat of a mystery until the very, very end. And so maybe I have stepped out a little bit, but yeah, the historical stories are just kind of what appeals to me. And so I look for characters that I can drop into history and see how they're going to react, how the emotions of history affect them.
Well, the research that you do, you said you researched for like a year for this last book, then a kind of a two-part question, how long did it actually take you to write the book? And do you find that that equation of time researching to time writing, is that about the same for every historical book you've written?
You know, everyone's a different journey. This book, I think it was 2016, September, after The Destruction of Silence came out, my fourth book, my third novel, I was pretty exhausted. That was an emotionally trying book. But then it was after the holidays of that year, I started to feel like I need to start writing again. And that's when my original idea from 20 years ago is I always wanted to write about what I call America's greatest crime, which was slavery, and its greatest sin, which is racism. And I wanted to write something like Toni Morrison had done with Beloved, where she used that character to, like I said, encompass all of the pain and trauma of slavery. But I never could find a character or something I could get close to. And that's when the idea, I said, well, when did Muslims first come to this country? Would that be something? And when I looked into it, I was just like, oh my gosh, there's my voice. And I had to find the character. And when I started researching, I started to realize there was so much information of African Muslims that had become enslaved. But getting back to your question, I didn't start writing until I felt like I had enough research, until I felt like I was immersed, like I could talk about the topic like it was any other knowledge that I had. And that just happened to take about a year. And then it took about a year to get a draft done. So that was basically the beginning of 2017 is when I started doing some research. So it took me about a full year all the way through. So sometime in 2018, I just started to draft, and I knew I had to write this from the first person perspective, which was different for me. My other novels were all omniscient narrator, third person, somebody just seeing into the world and telling how everything's happening. This is the first person. So Issa's voice is very important. And that was very difficult. I remember Junot Diaz, when he wrote his Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, and he said it was so hard to get Oscar's voice. And I didn't really know what he meant back when I read that book, and he was talking about, he was on every radio show and he won the Pulitzer for that one. And then when I knew I had to write this book from the first person perspective, I realized what he was talking about is to have that voice and make it genuine as though he's talking. It's his memoir. So anybody that reads the book, hopefully that comes off as the strongest aspect. Is his voice. It's him speaking in the I person. The first sentence is, my name is Issa Muhammad Rahman. In my 17th year, I set out for Timbuktu. He's telling you right away, he's telling the story and where he's going. But yeah, finding that voice. So it took me well over a year to get a draft. And then it just became, so that was all of 2018. And then all of 2019, just working on editing and revising. And then we actually went, my wife and I traveled to Boston, so that I could go to some of the places that appeared in the book. Because as Issa, after he is enslaved and he finally gains his freedom and goes to Boston and becomes an abolitionist, what I call an anti-racist, he was in Boston for a lot of time before the war breaks out. So I went to some of those places, and my character actually serves in the Massachusetts 54th Regiment, which was the first Black regiment of the Civil War. And I stood in front of that monument at the Boston Common. I just wept. It came to me. I get teary-eyed here. I was like, this is real. Like, I didn't know if I could do this book. It was doubt that drove me the whole time. Just keep working, keep working. But when I stood there, I finally realized, like, Issa's real. These guys, he's one of these guys. He encompasses all of these guys that served in the 54th Regiment and stormed Fort Wagner and sacrificed. And if anybody knows anything about Civil War and the storming of Fort Wagner, it was made in that famous film with Denzel Washington titled Glory. And there is documentation. There were several Muslims that served in maybe not the 54th, but in the 54th Massachusetts Cavalry. So for me, it was all about trying to fit all of this into history and making this character fit into a real timeline of history. But yeah, visiting those places then in 2019 and then coming back and doing some more revision and then having ready for 2020. So I guess it was about a year of research, year of writing, and then a year of just polishing, I guess, whatever you want to call that.
Yeah, and something I wanted, my next question for you. I know Grisham says he does not allow his characters to develop the story, that he develops the characters. But you kind of hinted that you allow your characters to lead the way or lead the story a little bit. From what, you know, as you were just talking about when you were in Boston and becoming emotional out over your character. I know that's the way I write. I'm just curious, is that what you do?
Yeah, I like to say that I know that it's working and the narrative is finally becoming effective and it's going to work when I just become the vehicle through which it's told. And my other ones were omniscient. So, of course, I was in control of narrating what was happening with all the characters. But in this case, yeah, I kind of just let Issa take over. I had a basic arc to this story. I saw the vision, as I mentioned earlier. I had a vision for the whole book. But a lot of things happened that I didn't foresee happening. And there were some things that I thought would certainly happen and didn't happen. So, yeah, I think you're right. I do let the character just take over. I had an arc. I had a vision. I saw where it was going. But I never know the endings of my books. And this one, it was well into like almost three-fourths before I realized that's how it's going to end. That's where he's going. And I hope that if anybody reads it, they get to that last chapter. And I hope you're in tears for good and bad reasons. But I think I like the endings of all my books. I'm partial, of course. I'm going to be biased. But this last book, I felt like it not only reflects the era, but the times as well. I feel like this book just resonates with what's going on today. And the ending, I feel like, is as powerful as it can be. And Issa took me there. He took me to the ending.
I think that's kind of important. For me, it's important as a writer in that the characters do become real to me. I know in the past when I would describe, my first novel came out, when I used to give my elevator pitch, I would give it in such a way everyone thought I was talking about real people. And they'd say, how did you meet these people? Or how do you know about that character? And, you know, I think that's, for me, it's important to really allow them to become real in your mind, so to speak, when you're writing the story, because they do lead you down a path and they can create, you know, where you're going with it. I think I've shared on the air that in my first novel, I actually had a character, I had to create a wife for him because in midstream, it didn't make sense for this guy not to be married. So I had to go back and reconstruct that whole thing with the thought of him having a wife. And, you know, sometimes you have to let the characters lead you down that path, to me, to make it interesting or realistic. And I like to write in a way that makes people think this could be a true story.
Well, I think that's part of it. They always say, you know, that nonfiction has to be, you know, believable, but fiction can be as unbelievable as you want. But the truth of the matter is that a lot of the things that happen in nonfiction are just beyond anybody's belief. You're sitting there going, did this really happen? And it's kind of a double-edged sword, because as a nonfiction writer, you want to be true to things. But if you put something in there that people are going to go, oh, how can that happen? All of a sudden you lose your credibility, where if you are writing fiction and you write it's outlandish, then everybody goes, oh yeah, well, it's fiction, you know? So, and it is true. It, for me, especially when I read or, you know, a writer's short story or whatever, I'm the same way. I never know how things are going to end. And I let my characters, they become that. I mean, I had a teacher a long time ago, and her name was Margelle DeLaura, and she was also an author. And she said that authors are like gods on paper because we create worlds and everything in them. And I just love that so much because it's true. And I've started out writing on something and you know, a good guy isn't 100% good and a bad guy isn't 100% bad. We all have our pros and cons about us. And that was just so apparent when she said that, because we can all find different traits in somebody as we go through a story. And like James just said, well, this guy had to be married. Well, I've written things and I'm going, well, I'm sorry, but this girl's got to be a little loose or this story isn't going to track right, you know? So it is about letting your characters create themselves and you just being the conduit that allows it.
Great word. I like that word, conduit, as well. But yeah, getting back to fiction versus nonfiction, you know, I go through spurts. Lately, I've been in a real spurt with nonfiction, reading a lot of nonfiction biographies. I've become very fascinated with Malcolm X, who's so misunderstood. Partly, I became interested in him because I've been interested in Islam for so long, and I revere Islam so much, and it's such an important part of my life. But I recently read his autobiography, which I found fascinating. And then I read the definitive biography of his life by Manning Marable, a book that also won the Pulitzer Prize. What an amazing piece of scholarship and history. But again, Malcolm wrote his autobiography. And when you read the biography, things don't always match up. So when you have more of an objective, somebody outside viewing it, like, for example, Malcolm, if you know anything about Malcolm X's life, he was imprisoned. He was a criminal. He committed robberies and thefts. But he makes himself out to be a much more hardcore criminal than his biographer. Manning Marable says he really wasn't as hardcore a criminal as he made himself out to be in his autobiography. So yeah, even when people are writing like autobiography, which is supposed to be based on fact, you know, they're even fictionalizing their own life. And so reading the biography versus Malcolm's autobiography, I felt like I had a real sense of who this man was. I'm very fascinated with him, and I hope that at some point I might be able to write another historical novel where he is in it, because I'm so fascinated with him, and I feel like he's been so misunderstood, and he's so important to American history and what he stood for, especially towards the end of his life. And it was Islam that actually opened up his mind to the fact that all races are, he should accept all races and work with all races. And that's one of the central tenets of Islam, is that everyone is accepted, that it alienates no one, that everyone has a place in the religion. So I've been really fascinated with that, but I'm trying to tie in the idea of fiction versus nonfiction, autobiography versus biography. It's amazing. And even, you know, people that write nonfiction, as I was researching too, I found different nonfiction authors writing around the same event and giving different details in different versions. So that actually emboldened me more when I'm writing as a historical fiction writer, is okay, all of these different nonfiction writers who have historians who have written about the same event are seeing it differently. I can take all of their details, and we know in time and place this happened, but how people felt and what actually went on in that moment, that's where the fiction writer becomes really important to me. And that's why I feel like this historical novel about this African Muslim who becomes enslaved, yes, he's fictionalized, but everything he experiences is what thousands of slaves, millions of slaves hope or felt. And hopefully he's an accurate representation of that. And also, like I said, an accurate representation of all of these Muslims that were here and that were Americans. They were brought here and they sacrificed. And that's one of Issa's motives in the book, is to become an American citizen, his belonging. Once he has a family here, he realizes he belongs here as much as everyone else. And he absolutely does. And that's what America is. We all belong. We all came from somewhere else. And he works as hard as anyone to sacrifice and become an anti-racist to overcome all of the hatred that, you know, started all this.
Well, I want to point out too that when someone's writing their autobiography as opposed to someone's writing a biography, we don't see ourselves the same way other people do, for one thing. And I helped someone ghostwrite their story. And when their daughter read it, their daughter said, "This isn't the way it happened." When the husband read it, he had another take on it. So even as we live our lives, as we go through our lives, and the way we visualize it isn't always going to be the same way someone else sees it. But keep in mind that in an autobiography, you're actually getting a firsthand account of what someone experienced. So it's probably going to be more accurate, to be honest with you, than someone else writing about you, because they really don't know that much about you. Only what they're researching, only what they hear from someone else. So you're getting a different perspective when it comes to writing biographies. It depends on who's writing it.
I agree entirely. Yeah, I mean, even biographers, you're still, they're trying to remain objective. But yeah, they're writers too, and they're feeling things. They're they're taking certain events in people's lives and trying to interpret them. So you're definitely right about that. I agree as well. That's why, yeah, when you're researching a topic, you know, immersing yourself in so much information, and then it's you're fictionalizing, like it's in some ways, it kind of empowers you to say, hey, you know, I can take some liberties here or there, or insert this detail because maybe there isn't a definitive truth to that moment or that detail.
Well, it's
going to add to that.
Well, when people actually, you know, when we write and we write about a certain villain, you know, everybody is coming from their own perspectives. If for say they had they were broken into and the person was blonde and blue eyed and had a mustache, you know, all of a sudden then that's what their villain is going to look like. If he was a big burly guy, you know, that was covered in hats, that's who they're going to see. Because everything we write comes from our own perspective. And if you talk to a police officer that has just talked to people about what did you just see in this car accident, you can talk to three different people and three different people are going to tell you three different stories, even to down to the color of the vehicle, you know, and we see that all the time. So, you know, and the other side of it too is most people are kind of our own worst critic. So when you say Malcolm was, you know, portraying himself as more of a criminal than the rest of the world saw him as, you know, perhaps that was a little bit of his own personality coming out there where, you know, I shouldn't have done that, or maybe this was too harsh and he's a little bit harder on himself than maybe someone that has looked at the end result, because I think that's a lot of it. When we write our own biographies, we try to take ourselves back to that moment in time, and that's what we were feeling. And somebody looks at it afterwards and goes, yeah, you know, that was a little harsh, but look at what amazing thing came out of it. Well, then it's colored with a little more kindness. And so maybe that's part of it too. And yeah. I feel that, you know, that is a big part of it. Like James said, you know, if you're writing your own story, it's you.
Yeah. I wanted to add too, to what Roger was saying, because I know Roger writes mainly historical fiction. And I wanted to, even though my first novel is not historical fiction, it is based on, or certainly my second novel is based on science fact and theory, as well as theology. So when you're writing something like that, even if it's fiction, you have to be careful to incorporate things that people will look up things in a book. They will look up and see, was this character real? Did this event really happen? Especially if you mention specific events. So I'm very careful that when I write about someone, like I wrote about Wilhelm Reich, in my story, everything I wrote about Wilhelm Reich, other than being reincarnation of one of my characters, is real. It's based on his real life. It's a true story. So I'm very careful, even in writing fiction, to make sure I've done research to balance out or validate the characters that I'm writing about.
Yeah, absolutely. Make a good point. Like I said, for me, it was doubt that was driving me. Can I really write this story? Can I really immerse myself in the time period in the antebellum South, in sub-Saharan Africa? I mean, can I write about this stuff? You know, I had to research enough to know where this character came from. And, you know, his character is not based on one real life figure, but there was one African Muslim who wrote a slave narrative. His name was Muhammad Ali bin Sayyid. And my character took very loosely after his life. So when I finally searched and found this character, I knew that my character was going to take a journey that was similar, but not exactly like this real life figure. And then there was another, you know, African Muslim that I researched or that I found, and it's like, oh my gosh, that detail will fit into my character's life. So he did a lot like Richard Wright did in Native Son, where people asked, Richard Wright was often asked in Native Son, what was the source for Bigger Thomas? And he said, well, he's based on a lot of people. And there's an introduction to one of the editions in which he explains it. It's fascinating how he says this aspect of Bigger Thomas came from this person he knew, and this came from this person. So for me, like I said, going back to the reading, all the reading I've done my whole life is helped to give me inspiration and sources for how to piece together these stories. So my main character, Issa Muhammad Rahman, is based on a lot of different real life people, but he becomes his own voice. And as I mentioned earlier, that was the most difficult aspect, is writing from that first person perspective. And is his voice going to hold up the whole book? And is it going to come through the intelligence of this man? That's one of the things I researched, is a lot of these Muslims, African Muslims, they were very educated. They knew the Quran. A lot of them had memorized it back in, you know, the mid-19th century that Islam had filtered down all the way into sub-Saharan Africa. And Timbuktu was kind of the center of Islamic learning in the early 19th century, like 1800, 1850. And no European had ever reached Timbuktu. But a lot of scholars would travel there. And that was the first sentence of my book, that my character was heading there to Timbuktu, which is very real for a lot of scholars. He was a young scholar, and then his fate became that he became captured and enslaved. But then his fight became to overcome that. So, you have to stay true to the facts. I think that this book, just like my other ones, I just recently reread my first novel, and I felt really great about it. I was like, oh my gosh, I had read a biography on Che Guevara, and it just got me to want to reread my first book for the first time in a long, long time with the new cover coming out. And I reread it, and I was like, wow, I think I really captured, this is a really good piece of history too, but you get to learn the history of the Cuban Revolution and what happened during the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis through a family and through these brothers. You're absolutely right. You have to stay true to some of the facts, but yeah, there's elements in the books that you have to stretch a little bit to make the chronologies work and stuff. But yeah, you really have to stay true to the facts. You want it to be real. And it is a challenge, you know, but I can't imagine writing a nonfiction book like a history of the Civil War. I would be terrified to do that, because it's just the amount of research. I'm just in awe over these guys that can do that. I read Grant's biography by Ron Chernow, Ulysses S. Grant. I was like, how does this guy do this? How can he write this? It's an amazing piece of literature about a man's life.
We're running out of time, so we're down to the last few minutes of the show. So, Cynthia, where can we learn more about your books?
Well, I'm very proud to announce that my books can be found on 1 Million Books in 100 Days, which is a wonderful project that not only showcases indie authors, but also a portion of the proceeds from selling the books goes to a couple of wonderful charities. And of course, James Kelly is the one who just made all this happen. So I'm really, really happy about that. And believe me, please go to 1 Million Books in 100 Days. There are so many great authors there, any genre you can imagine, and just have a great time checking us all out.
Roger, where can we learn more about your books?
You can go to my website, rogerdeblanc.com, and they're all there. There's links to any of the places you can purchase them, whether it's Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Libris. So you can get them anywhere. Just search on Amazon if you want, or search my name on the internet. My website should come right up, and there's links on the website to any of the places that you'd like to purchase it.
I do want to thank you, Cynthia, for that little pitch. I'll add to that a little bit. We created a website called 1 Million Books in 100 Days. That's the number 1 and then million books in and the number 100days.com. And it is to highlight self-published authors. Our goal is to do this twice a year. It's a campaign that runs for 100 days. I think we still have something like 50 days left on this campaign. So just go to 1 million books and 100days.com. And you can go to aspectsofwriting.com. And there's links there from Aspects of Writing to that website as well. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for being on the show today, Roger and Cynthia. And as I always say, if you can dream it, you can write it. Thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you, James. I'm so appreciative of this. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Cynthia. Great to see you again.
You too, Roger. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Aspects of Writing. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss every aspect of the writing industry. Until then, if you can dream it, you can write it.